Let's do it. Let's do it. Let's do a podcast episode. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Mundane Festival podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lamberth. Today is Sunday, April 2nd, 2017. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and on Podbean, the host site. If you like this show, please rate and review it on iTunes and or Stitcher. Give it a 5-star review. Let everyone know why you like it, because it will make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind. More importantly, what's on your heart. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival. And you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now on Twitter at Chris Lamberth. This is episode 213 of the show. I have a special guest, comedian, former rock star, Matt Ruby. He's got a new album out called Hot Flashes. It's available wherever you buy music digitally. I'll have the links onto the show notes and get it. It's a good album. We're going to get to Matt in a few. Right now, I'm going to talk to you a little bit. I'm going to shoot the shit with you. I'm going to share an email with you. I'm going to give you a new TV show review. And then I'm going to bring you over to Matt. Right now, I'm sitting here and they were showing the highlights of the Final Four, and I really could give a shit. I just don't care anymore. I'm really jaded now. I'm jaded about how they don't pay these kids and they scrutinize them. They try to mess up their draft status, and they treat them. You know, I was just thinking about like another reason why these kids should get paid, get some type of compensation, because they just scrutinize them like they're professionals. And this kid, like, he's probably like 20, you know, he's 20 years old or something, missed boxing out on two occasions, like towards in the final seconds of the game, on a foul shot or whatever. And then the ESPN shows him crying in the locker room. He's like, I could have boxed out. It's like, Jesus Christ. And as soon as the game was over, that fucking kid should have boxed out on Twitter. Just like, it's just like if you had the Final Four hashtag, it would just be blowing up of them, you know, criticizing that kid. I'm just kind of over it. I'm over it. And it's not, I'm on my soapbox and my high horse. And the altitude, my nose is bleeding. So let me get off of that. I just don't really care anymore. I did have a cool week though. I was just really busy. Sat in a lot of traffic this week. It's just so annoying, you guys. Sat in a lot of traffic. Did some auditions and I got to film something. I filmed. I don't know how much I can tell, but I did this. I did a pilot of this new show, and if it goes, it's cool. But if it goes, I'm just gonna be in the pilot because I played a cop, a ferry cop, and we shot it in Dumbo, Brooklyn, which is right by the Brooklyn Bridge, the ever continuing gentrified Brooklyn, and it was a lot of fun. And I was only supposed to have one line, but they needed like some filler stuff. So they gave me some extra lines to like improv and ad lib. And so I got to riff a bunch, and that was cool. And everybody was really nice. I had a fucking blast doing it. I just hope I can plug away and do more of those jumps, you know? And one of the things though, so I have a huge head. I have a size 8 head. It's really fucking big. And and I have a fro. I have like my hair's been long for like quite some time. And not super long, but I have a fro. If you've seen me before. And so the sides were kind of puffy. He said, the hair and makeup guy, he was like this middle-aged white guy. And so he said, okay, I'm just going to trim you on the sides a little bit, and you know, so it won't, your hat won't get tight, so the hat'll look good on you or whatever. And I was like, okay, do what you have to do. Do it for the, you know, for the show. You know, I'm thinking to myself, I'm getting paid. You know, give me a little shape up. Do whatever you need to do. And it's a white guy. So I don't remember the last time I had a white person touch my hair. Don't touch my hair. All right. It had to be. It had to be probably when I was doing, like, I was an intern at the Chicago Shakespeare Theater doing Julius Caesar, and it was just like a little trim. But so he does it, and it looked okay, but like then I was just like, oh, he just cut, like, trim the sides a little bit, and then it looks like I'm like a kind of like a Tuskegee Airman type haircut, or kind of like Denzel in Courage Under Fire, except I don't have like I don't have it faded, but it's just like that militaristic weird. It looks a little weird on me. I'm not going to lie to you. So I'm going to have to wait till that grows back, or maybe I just get my hair cut a little lower. And I don't know what I'm doing. I'm in this like mid, in this like in between stage of my hair, what I want to do with it. But overall, it was fucking awesome to spend a whole day playing pretend, like doing what I wanted to do ever since I was a kid. So it's good to get a little taste of that and have fun doing that shit. I had a blast. So I got an email I'm going to read to you. I've got a TV show review recommendation, and then I'm going to bring in a Matt. Okay, so this email is from Michael, and he writes, "Hey Chris, love the show. I've been listening since I heard you on the Black Guy Who Tips podcast. Hopefully you can make it out to the Toledo, Ohio, Detroit, Michigan area sometime soon." I hope so too, Michael. "I don't go to a lot of comedy shows, but every time I do go, there's always a commotion at the end of the night when tables get their final tab. There seems to always be one table arguing over the bill, trying to decide who owes what, or generally being loud. Eventually, the comic has to pause his or her set and address the situation. Do you have any stories of this happening to you? What can clubs do better to fix this?" Okay, thanks for the email, Mike. Yes, I've had situations like that. That time of the show is usually called the check spot. It's when the wait staff, everybody's like, ate and drank. It's towards the end of the show. The show's about to wrap up, and the wait staff will drop their checks, and usually, like, that's when people are, "Oh, I had a Sprite, but I just had, you had three Heinekens, and I had the Sprite, and she had the nachos." And then people do argue, because sometimes I guess they don't realize how much they've been having a good time, and then reality sets in, and they owe $100 or however much they owe. And then people can be a little loud when that happens. And usually sometimes the comic does have to intervene if it gets too loud. Just from a comic standpoint, if it gets loud in the show, during the show, if something's going on, a good comic would have to address it. But hey, what's going on here? And just, you know, like, get something funny out of it and keep the show going. But usually that's the case. I haven't had it. This has happened recently. I would say last year I was doing a show at Gotham Comedy Club, which is probably, Gotham Comedy Club is one of the best clubs in the city. It's they have a main stage, a main room, maybe seats close to 300, if not 300 or so. And then they have a vintage lounge, which maybe seats 80 to 100, something along those lines. And the vintage lounge is really cool. That's like where I feel like I can. It's probably one of my favorite. And you've heard me say this shit so many times, but I just love comedy. And so, but this room, I would say it has to be my favorite one of my favorite rooms in the city, but in the Vintage Lounge, because it's regular people. It's whether they're tourists or whether they're from the, they live in the city or they're just trying to have a good time. And it's a good mix of people, and it's late. It's like Dan Enfield and Alex Barnett have a show. Adam Oleonsis has a show down there. And it's like, it's really fun. And the show starts at like 10:45. So it might be over around 12. And I've closed out a few of those shows. And I remember one time I was up there closing out a show, and it was during a check spot. And there was this guy, and he had a date with him, and he just kept looking at the bill and was trying to talking. And he was really close to, he was like to my stage left. And he was talking. I'm like, what are you doing? And I just had to address, like, dude, what are you doing? Just pay for her. Stop itemizing the check and just pay for her, dude. Just please. And I was like, dude, you asked her out. Pay for this girl. And it got laughs. And then I just continued on doing my set. And I think one time, I don't know if it was that same show or it was like a, or a different one, but I just remember the crowd being a little rowdy. But whatever it was, I handled it. I get annoyed when I have to, when I've worked on bits and I want to just do them to see if they work, and you know, and then somebody's talking or something, and you have to like break, you have to like stop the show and address what the fuck they're doing, and it's annoying. Because you want everybody to have a good time. And because I'm a big black guy, then I kind of become an asshole because I'm saying, hey, what's going on? What are you doing? Like, I'm an assistant principal or substitute teacher, and I'm like ruining everybody's fun. But it was that person, it was that audience member that was ruining the fun. So there's always a danger in that. So and whatever it was, I handled it, I took care of it, the show was okay. And Gotham has guys that are either off-duty cops or former cops or just guys that have seen some shit, and they're in law enforcement of some kind, and they'll fucking take care of you if you're acting like an asshole. They'll get you out of the club. So one of those guys came up to me after the show. He's like, man, that was really good the way you handled that. Normally sometimes I would have to take the guy out and shoot him in the head and say, like, normally we kick those people out, blah, blah, blah. But you handled it. Sometimes in the main room, they can't even handle it. I was like, oh, wow. That was one of the biggest compliments I've ever gotten as a comedian. So it just depends on the comic. Like a good comic will try to make light of the situation and try to get them out. Clubs, it's really... It just, some clubs just do it seamlessly. I know, like, just the clubs that I've worked at, that I work at on a regular basis, like Levity Live, that's my home club, where it's a well-oiled machine where they drop the checks, and you can't really account for people being assholes. You know, I don't know what club that was, but you can't account for those audience members being assholes about the check. It's just like, yo, you drank all these beers, now you gotta pay for them and not fucking argue. Or if you are gonna argue, do it after the show. But sometimes people don't have that decorum about them, and you can't account for those people. So that sucks that you experienced that, man. And hopefully they get better at it. But I would just say, from a comic standpoint, you should be good enough if you're closing out a show to handle it. Or a lot of times, maybe if you're if you're going to a club that has a host, a middle act feature, and then a headliner, that's like the standard issue show. That's like a headliner show. But if there's a showcase where it's like maybe 8 comics and they're doing 10 to 15 minutes each, then there might be somebody that's doing a guest spot, which sometimes they call the check spot, where it's like you go on stage and the wait staff just drop the check and you have to be interesting and entertaining and earn your way into the club by doing that hard set during the show. And then I think I said the check. If you're at a headliner show and they drop the checks, that's just the check drop. And it's just the headliner's job to just be competent enough to deal with that. So I hope that answered your question, Mike. Thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate it. I hope to get out to Toledo and Detroit at some point in my career, hopefully within the next year. But, you know, who's to say? But the Lord Jesus and the comedy gods and show business. I will give you a TV show review. I didn't go to the movies. This week. It's been a couple weeks now. Like I just haven't been compelled to see anything. I'm really excited about this movie, Slight, like this kid with these superpower. It's like a hustler kid. And he does shit with cards, but it's in the hood. And so it's kind of like a superhero movie in the hood origin story. Got a bit of a Chronicle vibe. And then The Circle with Emma Roberts. No, Emma, what's my girl? What's the white girl that's been in the news talking shit about Beyonce? And she's in Beauty and the Beast. Emma Watson. Emma Watson and Tom Hanks and the homie from Star Wars. What's the guy? John Boyega. So that looks really good. And that comes out on the same day. So I might nerd it up and watch both of them. So I'm excited about those two movies, but that's not until the end of the month. And then if I see something, I'll let you know. Okay, so this show just came out on Netflix called 13 Reasons Why, and it's based on a young adult novel, and it's produced. Selena Gomez is one of the executive producers. So, you know, I had to see what Selena was up to. We'll see what, you know, Future Bay is like. I say Future Bay like 10 years from now. So I'll be 47 and she'll be like early 30s or something. Anyway, yeah, maybe she. Yeah, somebody else do the math. So Future Bay produced this and I was like, oh, shit, let me see what's good with this. So I'll read you the description. Newcomer Catherine Langford plays the role of Hannah, a young woman who takes her own life. 2 weeks after her tragic death, a classmate named Clay finds a mysterious box on his porch. Inside the box are recordings made by Hannah, on whom Clay had a crush, in which she explains the 13 reasons why she chose to commit suicide. If Clay decides to listen to the recordings, he will find out if and how he made the list. The intricate and heart-wrenching tale is told through Clay and Hannah's dual narratives. I like this. It took me some time to grow. Like the first couple episodes, I was like, okay, this is good. This is interesting. But I was kind of mad at the characters because, like, these kids are fucking assholes. And one of the things that I like about this show is the fact that it didn't really pull any punches. They weren't fucking around on the show. Much like I was talking to you guys about Burning Sands a few weeks ago, how you think it's just like, oh, this is, it's not, some of these college and teen shows can be very antiseptic. Like there's no like meat and bones to it, but it's like these kids are, a lot of them are fully fleshed out. They're very flawed. And I just like how some of the kids have the release to just say, hey, fuck you, man. To where like sometimes like a kid in a movie that's marginalized won't say anything or they'll just be like shaking in their knees. It's a good show. And when it gets to one of the climactic moments, there's a couple of them, but you're just like, holy shit. And it's like, oh my God. Like, I can't believe that they're actually going there, and it's not salacious. It's like, fuck, it's really grounded. It's got elements of Veronica Mars, a little bit of Pretty Little Liars. Shout out to Chelsea White, because I was texting her. I was like, yo, are you watching this? And she was like, I can't really get into it. And I was like, really? It's better than Pretty Little Liars. And she's like, what? But she said she couldn't really get into it. But I kind of do want her to watch it so me and her could talk about it. But it's, I really like it. I really liked it. It's intense. And I saw that a couple of people that from like back in the day were watching it. And I was like, yo, I'm watching it too. And so it's definitely good. I binge watched the 13 episodes over the course of like 2 days. I didn't do shit yesterday. I did go to Fuddruckers, but I other than that, I really didn't do shit but like watch TV. And I deserved it because I had a long week. So 13 Reasons Why, very, very good. I really liked it. It's good. It's up there with like these young adult shows that it's they're not fucking around. I don't know if they're trying to do. Alan Sepinwall did a really good review on it from Up Rocks, and he used to be on Hit Fix. I don't know if Up Rocks bought Hit Fix or not, but Alan Sepinwall, he's Sepinwall on Twitter, and he wrote a really good review and just touched on a lot of things that I just thought it was a good review on the show. But I was just pissed off at some certain things, and I think maybe if I get somebody on here that's seen the show, we'll talk about them. I ain't like how they did some of my hashtag black actors. Almost all everybody in here, all the cast members, all the kids on the show were, for the most part, were fucking assholes. And yeah, so solid show. Really, really, really liked it. So let's get you to Matt Ruby. Matt Ruby has got an album out. It's called Hot Flashes. You can get it wherever you buy your digital music and your comedy. Sunday, April 9th, a week from today, he's going to have an album release party featuring Alexis Guerreros. I know him. Jordan Temple. I know him. And Joe List, friend of the podcast from Tuesdays with Stories. It's going to be at New York Comedy Club in New York City at 9:15 p.m. It's going to be a great time. So if you enjoyed Matt on this podcast and you listened to him, and you could go see him, go see his, go to his album release show. And there is a promo code. Use code Hot Flashes for $5 tickets for that show. Normally they'd be $22. So save $17 by using Hot Flashes for $5 tickets at New York Comedy Club. All right. So Matt was one of the guys, one of the first people that I met when I started doing stand up. And he's just always been a really funny guy, just a professional, just a technician of comedy when it comes to it. He used to have a blog, he used to write about comedy and all that good stuff, and just a really funny guy. And what I liked about this album, we explore it a little bit during our conversation. I when I talk to a comedian that's done a project or has done an album, I usually like to pick out a bit, like one particular bit that I really enjoyed, and have them break it down to a certain degree, or have them discuss what's around that bit and what makes it great. I don't know. That's kind of what I like to do. So it was just a really good conversation. I hadn't talked to Matt in quite some time, so it was good to sit down with him. And I know you're going to enjoy it. So you're going to want to buy Hot Flashes by Matt Ruby. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Matt. Enjoy. I've done this show in far worse conditions than this. I've damn near done it in a war field. It's fine. It's totally fine. So you've been here for 6 years?
Yeah.
Have you just lived all around Brooklyn, or how many?
No, I lived a couple years in the East Village and then Fort Greene after that.
What do you like the most? Which area?
I mean, I love it here. To me, it's kind of like not as hipstery as Williamsburg and not as strollery as Park Slope, but, you know, still like cool stuff around and still like somewhat, you know, kind of mixed environment compared to other neighborhoods in Brooklyn. So I dig it.
But I feel like it's starting. It seems like this is starting to get there.
Oh sure, I mean, you know, once the baby store opens up, you know. And oh. So you know, it's like you see where it's going. But
yes. Yeah.
I do feel like it's and now that you have like these condo buildings going up around here too, so we'll see how that changes stuff. Because I feel like there was, you know, when there's only brownstones around, there's only so much is going to change. But as soon as like these towers go up with just like 20 floors, then it's like, okay, someone's got to move in there and take those.
Yeah, what do you call that? Like just that Atlantic terminal.
Yeah,
like that's
by
when
Barclays.
It just really felt like, why is this becoming like, I don't know what, like Western, what is it, Eastern New Jersey?
Totally.
Like it's just becoming,
because that's who bought it. It was like that Ratner dude who bought, like, you know, what is Barclays? It was like the rail yards. And so first thing he did was buy up. Are we actually
going
to
use
it?
You were going.
This? Okay.
We were using it,
so first thing he did, like, I'll just go off on a rant about this dude because I looked into it too much. But like, so he bought up all, like, put up these like malls and like Target and Buffalo Wild Wings and just whatever's the cheapest stuff you could find, and surrounded the rail yards. And it's like, okay, now I'm going to buy the rail yards and put up, move the Nets. You know, he owned the Nets. So I'm going to move the Nets there. Has Jay-Z be the face of it? It's going to, it's going to be like Jay-Z and me, and we're going to have the Nets in Brooklyn. And then, like, they got this sweetheart deal. It's going to be like a Frank Gehry design, like affordable housing all around that. As soon as they got the deal, a year later, there's a financial crisis. So then he sells the Nets. Jay-Z bails on the whole thing. The Frank Gehry designs and low cost housing goes out the window. And now you're just left with, like, you know, the Russian dude buys it, and it's just this arena for, you know, like, with like a strip mall surrounding it, and that's like that whole neighborhood now.
Yeah, it's kind of cold. I went to a game there. I went to a college game like last December, and then the year prior I went to a Warriors game. That arena just seems super cold.
Yeah,
this, like, it's, there's no heart to it. You know?
Also, no one really likes the Nets.
That's
so
true.
You, you know, like, you can call them the Brooklyn Nets, but I don't know anyone from Brooklyn who actually cares about them, so that makes it harder. And yeah, I mean, like, the Islanders, I think, just moved in for like a year or two, and now they're already like, we can't stay here. This place sucks.
They're going to move back.
They're moving back, somewhere. Right? I don't know where, but.
Yeah, it's just, it's weird because you come to New York for it's the culture, and you leave anywhere USA to come here to do what it, follow your dreams, do whatever the fuck it is. And then it's just the same. Like, it's just the same as the place that you left.
Yeah, I mean, if it's confined to a pocket of space, at least. I mean, like, you know, once in a while, it's nice to be able to have a Target nearby. You know,
oh, no,
but
it's
like,
true.
I hear you. Yeah, it's like.
I mean, I live in New Jersey, so I live in Hackensack, so it's a half an hour from here, but I can get all that stuff.
Yeah, it's. But you're right, though. That totally could be anywhere in America. That doesn't need to be New York.
There's just no call. Like, I was in Long Island doing a gig at a firehouse last Saturday, and it was just like, they're like, oh. I'm in Long Island. I don't spend that much time. A handful of times I've been in Long Island. It's just like, oh, there's a Best Buy, it's a movie theater.
Yeah, yeah.
There's, you know, and it's nothing new. It's,
yeah, yeah, no. California Pizza Kitchen. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
My sister lives in the suburbs, so when I'll go hang out there, I'm always, you know. You forget that New York is kind of unique in its layout. Although now it's like, I walk down the city streets, it's like Duane Reade, CVS, Bank of America, Chase, Duane Reade, Bank of America, CVS. You know, it's like, even in the city now, it's like, feels like it's tough to just be a small mom and pop shop.
It's true. And I think I've wanted to do something about, not like I'm doing anything about it, but just even if I go to a restaurant, to have it be like a mom and pop type place, to just try to spend my money where people need it, and where they're not just, I'm not just paying for their overhead because it's a trendy,
not just giving to a chain
place. Yeah, because I saw it when I left Chicago in 2007, and when I moved, I lived on. You're familiar with Chicago?
Yeah, I
used to
live there.
Yeah, we got to get into. We'll get into that. I moved there in 2003, and my first year I was living on campus in the Loop, and then. I moved to Wrigleyville, like on Waveland and Halsted, and it was nice. You know, of course, you're by Wrigley Field and everything, but then the year that I left, they put up a Whole Foods, rent went up, and I can just imagine what it's like now.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
I don't know. But you lived there.
I did, yeah.
How long did you stay?
I was there for about 10 years. I think I left maybe a year or two after you got there, sort of thing. But yeah, I lived
there for a while. Were you doing comedy out there?
I wasn't. I went to school out there, and then I was playing in a rock and roll band, working as a graphic designer, and I didn't start doing comedy stuff till I moved to New York.
Same as me. So where did it start for you? Where did you grow up?
I grew up like suburbs of New York, mm-hmm. Westchester County, like Dobbs Ferry and okay. Irvington. So I grew up there. Then I went to Chicago and lived there for a while, and then eventually came back.
So what was that? What was it like for you? Did you always, were you just always musically inclined or?
No, I think, I liked music a lot. I don't think I'm one of these guys who has like a natural musical talent or anything. Mm-hmm. I just kind of was very into, the good thing about rock and roll is you don't necessarily have to be, have a golden voice or be, you can like, part of what I loved about it was, sort of the rock and roll ethos of, what you're doing is more important than being perfect in how you're doing it. And sure. If you just, I don't know, for me anyway, I was in a band with some other people who were really talented. And so I got to, kind of hone my voice, I guess, as like a songwriter and, but more of like Lou Reed style than, Tom York from Radiohead or something like that.
Sure. What was the band? Like, did you guys make it? Did you guys make a mark? Did you like what, how hard did you go?
We made some sort of mark. I don't know if how long it stuck around, but yeah, the name of the band was Plastics Hi-Fi, H-I-F-I, which people always got wrong. It was a terrible name.
Can people find that online?
Yeah, we got an album on Spotify. We put out like 3 albums and, we toured around a little bit and, I think the albums we made were good. And you can find at least one of them, I think, is on Spotify and iTunes and stuff. And then I did like some solo musical stuff too. I think we were really good in the studio. We were sort of like, power pop, psychedelic kind of band, all loved like the Beatles and David Bowie and Velvet Underground, stuff mm-hmm. like that. And I think we made good albums. I don't know if we were ever like a great live band, like the kind of band that, you see and then like everyone, you got to come back and invite 10 of your friends. And like, I saw that, I remember like seeing the White Stripes play live in Chicago in front of like 40 people. And it was like this amazing show. Mm-hmm. And everyone in that room, the next time they came back to town, brought like 10 of their friends. And I was like, oh, okay, if you're that good, that's how this works, but otherwise you just show up and people are like, I don't know, have we heard of you before? I don't know what's happening. Yeah. So
it's funny, I was just listening to one of my favorite MCs on a podcast, and he was saying he sells out shows all over the country, all over the world, but only 50% of the people at those shows actually know his music, because the other half, there's friends that have brought that, so you got to come check this guy out. So what kind of places were you playing? Like, what kind of venues were you playing in Chicago?
Empty Bottle, Metro, Double Door.
I know Metro and Double Door.
Yeah. Elbow Room, we tour around, do other cities in the Midwest.
Yeah. And how long were you guys together?
Like 7 years.
That's pretty good.
It's pretty long run, yeah.
7 years, 3 albums, that's not bad.
No, we did all right.
How is the scene there? Because I only know Chicago... I didn't start until it's comedy until I moved here. I moved to Chicago for theater school, and I just know a little bit about that circuit. But it definitely seems like, I think I'll forever be indebted to Chicago for just kind of the work ethic that it just kind of fosters. Like, you're just working. You might have your day job, and then you go to rehearsal. Mm-hmm. You work your ass off, then you just go to rehearsal for the rest of the night. What was that like being a musician? Did you have a day job? What were you doing?
Yeah, I was working as a web designer, and doing like sort of beginning of like the startup tech world scene. So I was doing that. And then at night I was playing in a band. So yeah, we'd rehearse a couple nights a week. And Chicago had a cool like sort of indie rock scene going at that time. It was sort of, we were kind of after the wave of like Liz Phair and Smashing Pumpkins and
stuff like that.
What year are
we talking?
Like
late 90s?
Yeah, late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
I would say it was a great time to be in a band. It's also interesting to me now too, because in New York sometimes I'll like hang out with people who are musicians, and I think it says a lot about like the New York scene, where I feel like everyone's always in like 5 different bands, or they're like, whereas in Chicago, like, you were in one band and that was your band. You didn't gig around with a bunch of different people. And so
that's kind of weird though, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think it's like that New York mentality of like
seeing what hits.
Well, there's tons of people around who are talented. You try different things. It's the same, like, also people in the Midwest get married at 22 and stay married, like, whereas here everyone's like, maybe I'll have one kid when I'm 39, I feel like, you have a different sort of amount of circulation and people and expectations in the Midwest. That's, in some ways might be narrowing or whatever the right word is, but in other ways, like, you know, you kind of, you know, you pick your people that you're doing stuff with, and then you drill down on it. And you that was, you know, I was in a band with four guys for a long time, and yeah, it was like, you know, it kind of feels like you're in a gang with people. I mean, it's mm-hmm. like being married to three other dudes, so it was certainly yeah. an intense experience.
Was it why did you guys break up?
Eventually it seemed like we should be having more success or more fun.
do you just kind of wake up one day and then it's just like, I don't know if this is.
Yeah, I mean, I think after, you know, that last album we put out, I think we were hoping it would make more of a splash, or, you know, have, you know, back then the dream was like getting signed or being picked up by a bigger label. And like, you know, we didn't see that happening. And so that at that point it was sort of like, okay, well, let's. You know, I kind of wanted to do some solo stuff and tried that out for a while. And then I was playing with some other people. And the same week, the girl who I was living with broke up with me and the bass player in my band quit. And I was like, all right, well, maybe this is a good time to move, get out of here. If I ever want to move, this is probably like the right time to do it.
So you just
2 months later, I came to New York.
You came to New York. So you were from here. So.
Suburbs, though, because I always feel like city people resent when suburban people claim to be like real New Yorkers. Like I'm like a suburban kid.
But I would consider that. I mean, you kind of have to consider that to be a New Yorker, because there's so sure. many people. It's such a transient city that it's like, oh, well, you're just from 45 minutes away.
Right.
I remember seeing this movie. Oh, what the hell was the name of it? It was oh my God, the comedian. He does all the. Oh my God, that's so bad. He was in I See His Face.
Give me a detail.
He had his own show where he would do all these Johnny Bottle Service. What was that? What's that guy's name?
Nick Kroll.
Nick Kroll. So he was in this movie where he played a tech guy, and it was kind of like a Bernie Madoff type thing, and he the whatever his plan was flopped, and so he left town. And then there's a scene of him getting on the train, and he's just going to like Westchester. It's not that far.
Right.
Like, it was just like, I failed and I'm going to take a 30-minute train ride to back to where I came from. And it's just like, it's not that far.
Yeah. I mean, I think it depends, certainly, like, compared to people from Oklahoma or whatever. Yeah. I'm a New Yorker. But like, when I talk to people like born and raised and live their whole life in Manhattan, I'm like, you are a different species. They're on their own little wavelength.
What does that mean to you? What does that mean to you? Like, them being like a different.
People who have lived in New York City their entire lives, I think, are like the craziest people on the planet, because they think this is real. This is normal. You know, it's like, I think you gotta get out of the boroughs at some point in your life to see what else is happening on this planet.
But do you think that's what kind of shocked people with the way the election went?
To some
degree, like the way that it turned out, because I think sometimes, I mean, they threw this around, people being in their bubbles and not really realizing that there's another part of the country, even if you just go like 30 minutes away.
Could be, yeah. I mean, like, you know, I think it definitely gives you some amount of empathy or understanding for what else is out there mm-hmm. than just, you know, like, you know, East Coast liberal, you know, sort of NPR listening, like everyone agrees with each other.
Yes.
Sort of like, I mean, there definitely seems to be like a sort of zeitgeist of young New York creative professional political thought that, you know, if you get off that. If you veer off that conventional sort of way of thinking at all, it stands out because everyone here seems to agree with each other.
Yeah, that's true. Like the echo chambers get through all that stuff. I think being here, I mean, I grew up in D.C., mm-hmm. Washington, D.C. area, Maryland. And
where in Maryland?
Prince George's County, District Heights.
Okay.
And I went to Catholic school. Don't you have a sister in Virginia?
Maryland.
Maryland.
Darnestown.
Okay, because I remember some. What town?
Darnestown. It's right near Gaithersburg.
Oh, okay. I've never heard of that.
I feel like it's like they made up a name some place.
Dude, man, there's so many times where I could be on Facebook and I'll see like a guy that I went to high school with. He's checking in to like LA Fitness, or he's going to the movies, and he's like going to see King Kong, and it's like Skippensburg, Maryland. I'm like, what the fuck is that? Like that, what is that?
I think sometimes they just chop down some woods and build some homes and be like, here's a new town.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, sorry that you keep running over deer.
Yeah, it's so weird. I'm just like, what the hell? I just found that, I don't know why I brought that up. I don't know. But we were just talking about that.
Growing up D.C. versus New York?
Yeah, I mean,
I feel like they're pretty close, though.
Yeah,
right?
They're pretty close. Yeah, yeah. It's not that much of a difference, I would say. And I remember seeing you at the Draft House a few times, like going down there. So, I guess I just want to get into the album. I really liked it. I listened to it on the way to a gig, and what I appreciated about it was that, like, just the comedy that I enjoy the most is just where I could, after the set was over, I was like, oh, I got an idea of who that guy is.
Oh, cool.
You know, and it's like you, cause you have that nice mix of the autobiographical and at the same time it's observational, but it's just, it's woven in pretty tight, you
know?
Thank
you. Yeah.
So I guess maybe let's start a, because I'm thinking about doing one within either this year or within the next few years. When did you know it's the right time?
I'm not sure I did. It just sort of seemed like especially with like comedy industry stuff, a lot of times you're waiting around like hoping someone gives you permission to do something, or like some gatekeeper is like, taps you with a wand and you're like, I'm through these magic doors and now I get to do whatever I want to do. And, you know, I just felt like I've, you know, had accumulated sort of like this body of material. I also had a lot of older material that I'm like, this stuff is good, but I'm just don't want to do it anymore. And so like, I kind of wanted to record it on some level. It almost felt like, I'm thanking these jokes for their service and I'm recording them and now I will get to send them on their way and kind of like move forward on, you know, whatever kind of comedian I'm going to be next versus whatever kind of comedian I used to be, sort of thing. I felt like I was ready to do it and I had a good sort of backlog of material. And, so I just sort of set it for myself as a goal and set a date and then got a label and kind of, you know, grinded hard, you know, going on the road and stuff, just trying to get ready for it. And, yeah, that's how it came to be.
Do you have management that helps you book your stuff, or are you doing it all your?
No, I do it all on my own.
That's cool, man. I respect that. Like I guess I kind of want to do a little, be Tarantino-esque too.
Sounds cool. You want to curse more?
Is that what that means? No. I kind of want to jump a little bit because music, going from music to comedy. Where were you at in your life? So we got the finished product, Hot Flashes, good album, very good album. How do we get from your girl breaks up with you, you break up with her, break up with the band, you move back to New York? I mean, where are you in your life? Like, what's your headspace? What's in your head or whatever?
Yeah, I guess I'd been in Chicago for, like, I started to feel like I was becoming a Midwesterner and I didn't really want to be. I always felt like I was like a New York guy living in Chicago. But then after like 10 years, you're sort of like, okay, maybe this is who I am. And I always kind of missed New York and the East Coast. And, I mean, you know, I feel I had a joke about like Chicago versus New York people. It's like, what do you prefer, boring, nice people or interesting assholes? And decided to come back here to my tribe of interesting assholes, where I belong. When I first moved here, I was living in the East Village. I was doing shows as like acoustic singer-songwriter guy. Like I just put out like a solo album of music stuff. And I just realized like I don't like acoustic singer-songwriters. I don't want to be one. I always feel it's just like some guy with a guitar wearing a scarf who's like, you know, being romantic. And like that to me, what was, I was into being in a rock and roll band and like kind of being on stage with four guys. And so I wasn't really being as stimulated as I like via music as I had been before. And then at the same time, I was living in this village and going to Rififi like a couple times a week and seeing like incredible live shows, seeing like Patton Oswalt or Zach Galifianakis or David Cross, or, you know, people, I'd invite them up, and, you know, just sort of like that vibe and what I was sensing there to me felt more rock and roll than any of the music stuff that I was seeing in New York. It seemed like there's something cool and raw and like that was special happening in New York at that time. And I'd always been into comedy. I don't think I was ever like class clown or super funny dude, but like, I mean, from the time I saw Chris Rock bring the pain, I was like, how is this person allowed to say these things? Like I was always like, I'm very into the truth, or, you know, being able to get to it, or exposing hypocrisy or bullshit. And like, you know, like I just felt like comedians could do that more than anyone else. Like, why is this the one person on TV who's allowed to say the truth? And I was like, oh, 'cause he's made it really funny. I was like, huh, that's interesting. Well, what if I try to be funny? How's that going to go? And, so then I just kind of tried it as an experiment, and it was like a rabbit hole. Now I feel it's like 10 years later, here I am. It's like, you know, it's sort of, it's like a fungus that grows over your entire life. But also it's, I mean, I love comedy as a, you know, not just performing, but as a way of seeing the world, you know, kind of like trying to figure out what's surprising or weird or interesting, and, you know, who's full of shit and who's being real. And like, you know, it kind of breeds a certain like sort of outlook on living and thinking that I'm somewhat addicted to.
So was that like, how old were you when you started? Were you just,
I started late. I was 32. Okay. When I started. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know how much I like that term though, starting late. Cause I started late. I was 29, but at the same time, you've lived a life.
Yeah, I like comedians who are older. And I just think it's you know, you're going to waste like 5 to 10 years of your life just getting good at this game.
Yeah.
And so there's something to be said for wasting your 20s instead of wasting your 30s or 40s or 50s or whatever, whenever you start. But I agree with you. Like, older comics, I think, often have more interesting points of view or things to say or life experience to draw on.
Yeah. That's kind of how I felt, because I lived, I failed, and I think I was at a point where, for me, I had just suppressed it. For my listeners know, I just suppressed it for the longest time. And then I went down to, I was hanging out with some friends, and they were kind of living like they were the cast of Entourage. And I didn't have that Entourage type of money. So I remember just getting out of a cab, getting ready to get on a train. And I just went down to Comics and just saw, like, signed up for the open mics, just like looked at, talked to the bartender, they told me when to come, and I never stopped, you know. So, yeah, I don't think there should be a problem with that, starting late.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think artistically there's a problem. I think just sometimes, like, lifestyle-wise, that could be a problem, or industry-wise. The industry is much more excited to have, like, some, hot new, you know, 23-year-old.
Well, the half-hour list just came out today, and one of my friends texted it to me. I was like, oh, I guess I didn't get it. I mean, I knew, because they said they would let everybody know around February, like late February, and it's like March 21st, whatever, as we're recording, is what, the 20th? Yeah, whatever it is. Anyway, but that's not going to stop me, Matt. I just kind of had it in my head where it's like, yeah, maybe I'll try to do an album. But then at the same time, when you're doing the road, it's like, oh, this joke is different. Like, oh, this grew a little more. Or I just feel like it's you have more room to grow when you do the road. I just don't feel like you can grow when you're just bopping around like the boroughs, or really you're just in Brooklyn.
Well, I mean, just doing longer sets, I think, is also just a huge thing. You know, when you're doing an hour versus 8 minutes, it's a whole different animal.
Yeah, yeah. So did you have, like, where were your parents around when you were in this? I always ask the artists about, like, well, what did your parents think about you? Like, this change from going to, like, a rock and roll guy to an acoustic guy, and then to a comedian.
Yeah. I mean, I think they've always, you know, but now both my parents have passed away, but that was within the last, you know, 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. So I can't say, I can't speak to how they would feel like right now, but I think, you know, they were always supportive of me. My mom was an artist and, you know, sort of a poet seeker type. So she was always supportive of me, you know, kind of doing anything that was artistic or, you know, And my dad was more just, I think, apathetic about stuff in general. So he's like, yeah, if you're happy, whatever. So they were, there wasn't any, you know, intense pressure in any direction to do anything. They were pretty hands off overall.
Oh, really? What did your dad do?
He was a lawyer for a long time, like a prosecutor in New York City, and then went into private practice and then did some other stuff.
So like hands off, they were just like, kind of like, just not a, not,
if you don't ask us for money, do whatever you want to do.
Okay. All right. That, okay. Yeah. So, I guess what I look at you as like just a comedy vet. Cause when I first started, I remember you were the guy that had, you had your blog, your sandpaper suit blog, and you'd have like stuff about comedy, different goings on. How have you seen comedy change within the last like 5 to 10 years, like in New York City? What do you think about the, I always say, quote unquote, New York comedy community?
I mean, I think it's good. I think we have like the best comedy scene in the world, or at least that I've experienced. And yeah, I don't know if I have, I don't know if I think about like the scene in that way. I just think of like individual comics and people who I know, and if they're doing well, and if they're, you know, and I think it's like, I guess maybe 5 years ago, like The Stand wasn't around and New York Comedy Club wasn't a good place. And like now both, those are two of the best places in the city. So I think a lot of times like a scene is determined by, you know, venues and, you know, sort of people supporting it. And, you know, I think what Rebecca's done at the Creek or things like that. I mean, I think sometimes you just, you know, venues like that have risen, you know, in the past decade in a way that probably like has really helped the scene out a lot. And but as also, I think there's just sort of more of a, people are more comedy savvy in general now with like Netflix and, you know, just sort of the internet. And I think people are wiser about comedy and like it more than they did, you know, maybe, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. So, but that said, that means there's a lot of people who probably aren't, you know, as serious about the craft or however you want to put it, who are doing it, who are just, you know, trying to get on TV or trying to, you know, use it as a stepping stone to something else. But I think you always have that to some extent.
Oh yeah, definitely. I felt for me, like, I guess maybe I'm just a sentimental guy, but I just know when comics closed, it was kind of like this diaspora of like comics just kind of spreading out, going to different places. And it just didn't feel the same to me anymore. But I think just hearing you mention those things, like, I guess it's not so bad. I don't know.
One thing we are missing is, which is what Rafifi had or Cabin when that was a show, was like a place for comics to like congregate and hang out. Like, so there'd be a show, but even if you weren't on the show, like people there afterwards at a bar, just chilling and with somewhere that had cheap beers and stuff like that. And I feel like that's something that's missing from the scene nowadays. It just seems a lot more like people in their own little like sort of cliques or venues wherever they hang out, but there isn't that sort of like coming together the way there used to be.
Yeah. Part of me feels like, I don't know, because I feel like I'm stuck in between two worlds, which is my corporate America job and then like show business comedy. But I feel like even though I can be a little, I guess sometimes I can be like misanthropic, a little J.D. Salinger-esque about
a comedian who's misanthropic. This is shocking.
Well, you know, like I'm just like, oh, it's not all that, you know, so-called comedy community. But I feel like there's certain times where if I've had a long day at work and I'm just doing a show, just like a bar show, it's like, oh, I really did need this. Like you could just be talking about, you could talk about anything. You could be talking about comedy. You could be talking about the game, but with other people that are like me, you know, like,
well, also with comedians, sometimes I think it's just a way of talking, like, you know, then because if you're in like a corporate environment, you start talking the way you talk to a bunch of comedians in the back of a bar, they're all going to be like, who is this guy? Like there's lawsuit territory you got to worry about.
Well, that,
like comedians are hanging out. It's just like, look, it's no bullshit. Or like, yeah, like half of them are probably like addicts in recovery. Yeah. And like, there's just, you're going to get a no bullshit sort of like view of the world in a way that is, you know, sometimes healthier or different than what you get in day-to-day life.
That's true. But I often find myself at my job being just the guy, because it's almost like a Clark Kent Superman thing where it's just like, and they might know that you do comedy or whatever, but they're the ones that are speaking with graphic language or doing just like, oh, you really? Okay. Like,
I got an idea for a joke you got to do. Like, yeah. Oh, please don't.
Or,
please don't.
Yeah. Or even just like, there's this one guy who's very nice. I call him the Michael Scott of The Office because he's just, he's always saying these things that are off color. Now, to me, it's not going to make me blush, but it's just like, dude, just don't.
Yeah.
Don't say that. Come on. Don't say that. But no, I do. I think being a little more positive about the comedy community, it is a good place, though. It is good. I mean, it feeds me intrinsically. Like, it's just like, oh yeah, I did this show, it was fun, I got to work on some stuff, and I'm around these people that do the same thing that I do. They challenge me to get better indirectly, and you know, so I think that does help. I don't know where I was going with that, but just like, I think you just made me kind of recalibrate my thoughts on the comedy community.
Well, I mean, I think it's like any scene, it's like there's probably, you know, good and bad
points to it. Yeah, you
know,
definitely.
It's certainly, I don't know if it's healthy to hang out exclusively with comedians, you know? So it's,
oh, yeah, no, you got to.
It's like anything else, you got to have some dynamics or mix it up, probably.
Mm-hmm. Do you have that in your life? Like, do you have that?
I try to.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's an ongoing battle. Like, sometimes if I'm, you know, doing things that are hanging out with people who aren't comedy related, I'm worried, like, oh, I'm losing ground. I should be, you know, doing X amount of shows per week or, like, you know, just grinding away on some other level. But then another side of me is like, yeah, but, like, maybe you should have, like, a full life, and then you'll have more interesting things to talk about on stage and actually, you know, be able to do this in a more sustainable way than, you know, devoting your whole life to it and having no other interests whatsoever.
Living a life worth commenting on,
yeah. Yeah, and also just being like the kind of person who's like capable of like hanging out with people who are not comedians. I feel like that's a pretty good area to be in, as opposed to someone who can only like communicate and date and hang out with other people who are doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah, that's a thing that I've been trying to work on, just like having getting a girlfriend or just living like that whole living a life worth commenting on thing. I think it's something that I'm working with, like struggling for. I know I did last year, but so far, we'll see. I just try not to be like, I don't want to be. I guess it's just like with entertainment, like with theater, acting, and comedy. It's just I throw myself into it, and I have done it for so long that you don't want to be like just that one thing, because it's fulfilling, but at the same time it could be empty, because it's like, oh, I did this thing or I got this part, but you don't have anybody to share that with, or there's nobody to have that balance.
I think that's a good point, is like to look at your best case scenario and make sure that it's something that you really want.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, because that's the way sometimes I feel about like, you know, being like a road dog or something. I'm like, oh, do I actually want to be in like Winnipeg and Tulsa and, you know, Des Moines and like spending like 2/3 of my year in places like that? Or, you know, is there, you know, another path that I, you know, like to pursue? Or I don't know. I think that sometimes it's like you can be envious of other people for getting things that you're not getting. And yet at the same time, I think maybe a better question is like, do you actually want to trade your life with their life? You know, because a lot of times I've found that's not always the case. So
speak on that a little bit, like even just a little bit about just doing the road and what that's like, what that does to you. And then just, I guess, just relate what your mindset is when it's coming time to really put this album together, I guess, like kind of weave. I'm asking you to weave all that in, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, I think it's, you know, I haven't been on the road as much as like some other people, but I can already sense from when I am, like, yeah, there's like certain like just level of loneliness. Like you're just out there doing it on your own, unless you're on tour with like some other people. Like that's one thing about being in a band versus being a comedian, is like you're doing it with other guys. But like, yeah, if you're just, you know, staying at a hotel and like, you know, you don't talk to anyone else all day, and then you go on stage and talk to, you know, however many people are there, and then like, you know, have a couple of drinks and then go back to the hotel. It's like, that's kind of fun at first, but like how, like, is that the lifestyle that you want to lead, and for how long, and, you know, like, or how do you balance that versus, you know, if you're also wanting to write or act or, you know, podcast or do other stuff. So, I mean, and yeah, for me, especially before going in and taping the album, like I just wanted to have reps of doing longer sets, which are hard to get in New York. You know, like most sets here are usually like 15 minutes or less. And so I wanted to, you know, be able to, you know, run an hour, you know, a bunch of times leading up to the taping. And so I just kind of took a bunch of gigs, you know, wherever I went out, you know, the West Coast for a couple weeks. And then, you know, I was in Chicago. I remember like driving through a blizzard to perform at like a hookah shop, like the week before my taping. And I'm like, I know there's going to be like 10 people there if I'm lucky, but you know what? I want to run this hour for me, for whoever is there, because I'm about to do something and I want it to be good. So, but yeah, you kind of, you have to get in. I think you have to get out of that mode of like, is this drive right now through this blizzard to this hookah store worth it? Mm-hmm. Clearly, no.
Like, right.
Clearly, it is not worth it. But if it's part of some bigger thing that I'm doing or like that I'm trying to like craft together, and like, you know, that to me is then when it's like, okay, well, I'm not doing this for tonight for this thing. I'm doing this for this album that I'm taping that's going to be recorded and for history that, like, you know, people can listen to. And so, you know, I guess maybe sometimes that's the angle that I take on things, is like more just like caring about the work and wanting to be proud of whatever you're doing, people coming to see you or people listening to your album, and just wanting to be like, yeah, I did everything that I could to make sure that this experience that you're having is as good as possible. And then, you know, just like also in New York, you're like competitive because you have like some of the best comics in the world here. So, you know, you gotta bring it if you want to like keep up, and, you know, just try to constantly be, you know, using that as healthy fuel to like continue to get better and improve and try new stuff, and not just, you know, rest on your laurels. Or like, you know, I think, especially with comedy nowadays, I think it's like, you got to keep generating material and coming up with new stuff. You can't just like keep the same, you know, bits around forever. So, it's just sort of a healthy way to kind of burn down the forest so the new trees can grow, I guess.
Do you have anyone of your friends that you're close to that you work on, you talk about your bits, or do you have anybody to bounce stuff off of, or is it just like this total solitary?
No, but like, I don't have like a regular like sort of writing partner that I work with, mm-hmm. but I have a bunch of comics who I'm friends with who,
yeah, have, like, not like they help you write, but you're just like, you, somebody you check in with, like, you opinion of someone's opinion that you respect, where it's like, what about this tag, or what if you did this, or...
Yeah, well, I mean, I do Hot Soup, which is a show with, yes, Gary Veeder and Mark Norman. So, you know, like, just from doing a show together every week, you know, we wind up hearing each other's bits. So mm-hmm. I'll wind up talking with them about stuff. A bunch of other, you know, comics who... Yeah, it's usually, like, after a show, if someone sees a set, I'll be, like, you know, having a conversation with them. Sometimes I'll sit down and do, you know, a writing session. Like, the other week, Alan Gunn and I sat down and went through some stuff. But yeah, it's sort of flexible, but like, I don't have like a set routine. And I think I used to be probably more collaborative on stuff earlier on, and now I feel like maybe I have a little bit more of now I get more stage time, and also have a little bit more of a, you know, I think, angle in my own head of when I know something's going to work, or if this feels good, or you know, like how to take an idea from beginning stages to an actual bit.
Yeah. So you, how many places did you tour? How long did you tour before the out you recorded? You recorded in Chicago, right?
I recorded in Chicago.
Where'd you record it?
There's a show out there called Comedians You Should Know. It's mm-hmm. a really good show. They also have, you know, an offshoot in New York and LA now, but they've been doing it there for years, and it's this really fun room downtown that I performed at before. And I kind of like that vibe of, you know, a hot show, but also, you know, sort of small and in the back of a bar, and, you know, kind of similar to Hot Soup, the show that I do. I kind of felt like it was, had a similar vibe, so I kind of like that. And I think I set the date maybe like 3 or 4 months out, and so I just kind of knew that I wanted to get up as much as I could, so that was, and I was doing some stuff out in LA anyway, so I kind of just stretched that from, you know, LA and then San Francisco and then Victoria, BC, and did like a couple weeks on that whole stretch. And down in DC, I did a bunch of shows, and then I went out to Chicago a week early and was doing a bunch of stuff there. And then some other, where was I? Nashville or a couple other places too, but just trying to like, you know, sometimes they'd be really great shows, sometimes they'd be mediocre, but just trying to like get out and do jokes. Also, it was I recorded December 7th, so it was like an interesting time of year post election to try to, you know, figure out like, okay, you know, America has shifted on some level, and so do I want to talk about this? I want to talk about and do, like also just not talking about it in a way that wasn't just for New Yorkers, but knowing that like, okay, I've done this in different parts of the country and even in Canada, and like kind of knowing how stuff would play, not just in front of a New York audience, was helpful for me. Not that, you know, Chicago and New York crowds are that different, but you know, it's nice to know you're out, you know, outside of the bubble of however people here are thinking and talking about stuff. And then also like doing Week at the Creek, you know, doing, you know, an hour, like, five nights in a row, even though it was like, you know, not always the best of crowds, but you know, like I remember one night there was like just four Australian girls who like wandered into that room, and I did my hour for these four Australian girls, and it was like a great like run through of it, and I got a bunch of tags, and it's like, so sometimes you can, you know, have this show that you're like, oh, should we even do it? And then it turns out to be like, oh, I got a lot out of this. And then there was other nights that were packed out and great shows, which, you know, sometimes, you know, that's good for the confidence, but you know, it's also, you know, like sometimes those crappy shows, if you can take it, if you could take a show that clearly should be a failure and turn it into a victory, then you're like, all right, I feel like this material is pretty good.
I just kind of figured out last fall where it's almost like comedy's like, I don't know if you're a gamer at all, but like it's like a role-playing game. Like you build up your experience points, where if it's a show that you had to kind of slog through, but you get through it, like one of those bar shows where it's loud and you're just, I remember doing a show in Troy, New York at a bar show, closing it out. And it was just, the host did his thing. He like, you know, he opened them up. The next guy opened them up and I had to really like, just like really finish them off. And it was just like, it felt good. Like it wasn't the greatest show, but I felt good. Cause I felt like we got through something together. And it was a good experience where it's just like, oh, I can do this. I can take down this monster. Well, what else can I do? So I think you do learn more from those rougher shows, I think.
Yeah, I think, I mean, they're different skills. I think like to take like a dead room or a tough room and like turn it into like a good show is certainly something that I think New York and especially like doing shows here will teach you. And then I think, you know, sometimes, you know, doing like a hot room and being able to like just keep the energy going, like that's also like, you know, sometimes that's similar but different in a way of like they're already on board, now you just got to keep it going, versus, you know, sometimes I feel like we're trying to like manufacture something from scratch.
And now when you did this album, when you recorded it, were there did you do like, you did like two shows?
I did, yeah.
And did you like cut stuff out, or did you?
Yeah, it's almost all the first show, because that crowd felt you know, a little bit hotter, but like maybe like 10-20% from the second show was worked in, just a couple bits that, you know, maybe had an extra tag, or you know, the crowd reaction was a little bit better on
one thing. Because, and I just want to get back to some of the stuff that I liked about it, like, because I remember because just following you on Facebook, I don't know that you post as much as you used to, or maybe you're just not coming up in my feed. I don't know, whatever the algorithms or whatever do, but I just remember this one post that you wrote about your mother when she passed away. It was just this really heartfelt thing, and I was like, ah, you know. And I remember, so it just kind of like clicked for me when because I was driving listening to it, and you mentioned like you're I don't want to give anything away, but there's a section about your mom, and you, I don't know how much I want to really
go for it, whatever.
Getting high with your mom.
And
how did, I guess I just want to, it's almost like, without giving away the bit, I kind of want to get into like the heads, because that was probably one of my favorite parts of the set, which was just like just this emotional thing that was probably hard for you. How did you get to the place where you were able to talk about that on stage, and how long did it take for you to, you know, get it to the performance level.
Sure. Yeah. So my mom was paralyzed and had MS, and so it's a bit about, you know, she got medicinal marijuana and smoking with her and kind of around that, just to give people some background. But yeah, I mean, that's a good example of something that I feel comfortable doing in a longer set. Like if I have like an hour, if I have like 8 minutes, it's tough to just open up with the paralyzed MS mom bit, because that's a little bit heavy out of the gate. But also like kind of, I think it's, I don't know, it's like, that kind of stuff, I think, is something that comedy can do that you can't do otherwise. I don't know. It's sort of like the point sometimes, I think, is to go to darker places.
Yeah,
or, and, you know, it's one of those things where it's like afterwards, then, you know, you have enough people come up to you and be like, you know, I'm glad you talked about that. Or it was all, you know, I can relate because I went through this with my parents or something, like, you know, stuff that's maybe a little bit deeper than, you know, what comics are usually talking about. But then you get a different sort of response from an audience. Like you get laughs, but also you feel like maybe you're making a little bit more of a connection, or that there's some actual like vibe or wavelength that you're achieving that's beyond just, you know, easy laughs, but like kind of like what they're connecting, you know, on a deeper sort of more soulful level in some sense. But it's certainly like a challenging thing to go there, you know, and come back out and make it funny. And it's like, you know, I kind of, you know, give myself a little bit of a longer leash for stuff like that, but I still wanted to have punchlines every, you know, like reasonable amount of time, so people are laughing throughout. So I think that's the challenge of like, how do you, you know, unless you want to be a storyteller or something where you don't care. Mm-hmm. Like, to me, you're a comic, you're supposed to be getting laughs. That's the deal.
Yeah.
So you got to kind of massage that of like, here's what I want to say, and here's this thing that I had, you know, in the relationship with my mom and what that was like. But also I'm going to make it somewhat funny and relatable because we're at a comedy show. And so, yeah, I think that's definitely a challenge that, you know, took me kind of years to kind of, you know, start that bit. And then, you know, I stopped doing it for a little while, and then I brought it back and added some stuff and, you know, sort of, you know, at the end, before taping, I think within the context of a larger album, it kind of made more sense, because I have some stuff that's certainly more like the easy laughs or observational or something like that. But then you can get a little bit deeper, more soulful. And I think that balance kind of helps. Like, I think you see that in like Judd Apatow movies of like, you know, there's going to be a bunch of like jokes about like jerking off and weed and stuff like that. But maybe those are the things that enable him to kind of get into deeper stuff about relationships and, you know, whether they're romantic or like in funny people, like, you know, death or things like that. And, you know, you can buy yourself, they kind of maybe they need each other on some level. You can have like a couple jokes about like sex or bathroom stuff or whatever. But, you know, and then you can have some deeper, more soulful stuff. And maybe together, that's actually the formula for what works. You know, if you lean too much one way or the other, you might fall off.
Yeah, because you have it all there. I mean, it was just what struck me was, because when I think about your comedy, I think about this guy's a technician. Like, you're a funny guy, but you're just like, you're very, it's almost like, it's observational, it's smart. And it's just like, you're chipping away at, you're getting this thing. And so hearing that bit, I mean, there's, and definitely the relationship stuff. But that, I think that just struck a chord with me, because I was like, oh, he went, I was like, oh, cause it kind of shook me up. It shook me up a little bit, where I was like, oh, he's doing this. And it reminded me of when, God, I want to say it was like maybe 2010 or 2011. I saw Marc Maron he recorded the album This Has to Be Funny.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it at Union Hall, and he was doing this bit about how his mother says something like, I wish I knew how to love you. And he was talking about throughout the course of the chunk, he was talking about how he was with his parents, and he was following, he had a notepad writing down the shit that they would say. Oh, this is funny, I'll write this down. And then his mother says that, and he's like, oh, I don't need to write that down. And then there was this one audience member that was like, oh my God, that's so, and he was like, no, this has to be funny. Like, I've dealt with this already, so I'm presenting it to you. Now you have to laugh. So it just, was that like a few years? So that's basically a few years for you to get to that place to where you're recording the album and you're doing that bit. Was that like a couple years? Like,
I mean, the actual thing that I'm talking about, it probably happened like 10 years ago. And then I remember I first tried it as a bit for maybe a year, like, you know, like 5 years ago or something like that.
Okay.
And again, it was like I wasn't doing, I was doing more shorter sets, and it just didn't feel like it fit in like so much in a short set. But then I think knowing that the taping was coming up, that's when I kind of revisited it and wanted to, you know, think about like, okay, because I knew it was like right on the edge of like, sometimes it's just like, it's like a bit is like climbing a mountaintop. It's like, I felt like I had gotten it to like base camp three, but it's like, okay, it wasn't at the summit yet, but I'm like, you know what? If I go out for like a month in a row and do this bit every night, like I think I'll probably like figure out like I'll crack the code on how to get to the peak of it. And, you know, I think, knowing that the taping was coming was probably like the initiative to try to like, yeah, man, how long are you going to have this joke trailing around behind you? You better like either figure it out, or if you're going to figure it out, now's the time.
Is there some sort of, I don't know, is like a catharsis once you like have that bit and you get the laughs that you wanted? Is there some, does that help with, I don't know, I've never lost a parent, so I don't know. Like, is that something that just kind of helps you? I don't know if you can ever move on from a death of a parent. But
yeah, I don't want to overstate. You know how that it's helped me heal. No, I'm just asking.
Yeah. I just want to know.
For me, it's a little bit more. I don't understand why we aren't all talking about this stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. Like everyone's going to, you know, if you haven't dealt with it yet, you're going to.
Yeah.
A lot of people that you know have dealt with it. And as a society, we just kind of decide like, oh, that makes us uncomfortable, so let's pretend it's not happening. And that to me is sort of like that friction sort of causes more harm probably than just being like open and honest and talking about like what it's like, you know, with, if you have a parent who's sick or, you know, dying or whatever else it is. And it's just sort of like, to me, maybe it's just, if I'm thinking of it as cathartic in any way, it's just the ability to talk about stuff in a real manner, as opposed to being like, oh, this is going to make people uncomfortable, so I better not go there. You know, just being like, you know what? Like, yeah, maybe it'll make you a little bit uncomfortable, but also great comedy sometimes involves tension. And like, if you have a little bit of tension built in, that's not always a bad thing. So like, okay, let's make it a little bit tense now. And then once you get to the other side of it, then it is almost like a bigger release, I think, sometimes.
And then you mentioned something that I think is important too. Like, so you set the deadline of you got to record this album and then you got to do this bit amongst the other ones that you're working on. Do you feel like that forces you, even when you're doing short sets, to just like take those chances of just getting it out there because there's a looming deadline over you?
Yeah, there was definitely, you know, a bunch of bits that I felt were like maybe like three quarters of the way there. But I'm like, you know, I'm a big deadline guy. I don't like hustle like until like I'm like, oh shit, I better hustle now.
So I do feel
like there was some of that of being like, okay, well, this bit is either going to be like mediocre and not on the album, or else you're going to push it through and figure out, you know. And a lot of times it's just like one tag or one line or you know, and sometimes it's a bunch of stuff just unleashes. But yeah, it's just sort of, also I think there's something to be said for like, I had some older bits that, you know, maybe I'm just a better comedian now, and so like going back to them in a way of like, okay, try this again, and be like, oh, now this clicks, or now I know where to take this, whereas maybe before I didn't.
Yeah. And so is the relationship stuff, dealing with the breakup, does that help in a similar way than like dealing with?
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely, my relationship stuff is very a composite character sketch, as opposed to like a specific truthful, like, this is what's happening in my life right now thing. But I mean, relationship stuff is, you know, I feel like that's something I've just been working through in my life in general. And so certainly like my comedy has reflected that. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, it's like one of those, you know, I guess maybe some people might think it's hack, but like, to me, it's one of the most relatable things that I can talk about, that I actually like care about and want to talk about. And like, I mean, I remember Chris Rock being interviewed, I think it was Charlie Rose, and he's asking him about being a political comedian, because, you know, it was after like that whole Colin Powell bit, and Chris Rock is like, you guys are the ones who call me a political comedian. You know what puts people's butts in those seats is when I talk about relationship stuff. That's, you know, so you could look at Bring the Pain. Like, he ends with relationship stuff. That's what he ends with. He's like, all the political stuff is what you guys talk about, but like, I know what the people most want to hear is me talk about that stuff. And so I kind of, you know, would echo that on some level. I feel like sometimes that's the stuff that I'm doing that is the most resonant for like a wide you know, sort of swath of the audience.
Because everybody can relate to that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's men and women having to deal with each other is proof that comedy exists for a reason. You know, it's like, this is like, you know, we've been forced to deal with each other in a way that does not make sense. So now we got to figure it out.
That's true, man. So this is great, man. So when does the album come out?
March 31st.
March 31st, Hot Flashes. Where can people find you? Yep.
Be on iTunes and Spotify and Pandora, wherever digital albums are sold. I think you should be able to get it. It's coming out on 800 Pound Gorilla Records. My name is Matt Ruby, R-U-B-Y. And
Twitter.
At Matt Ruby.
And I'll tag you and put all that in there.
Perfect. I love being tagged. Yeah. Tag me up. But yeah, I think it should be available wherever comedy albums usually are available that are digital.
Are you going around? Are you touring or are you doing any shows? Anything?
I'll be doing an album release show in New York on April 9th at New York Comedy Club, 9:15 p.m. MattRubyComedy.com has my info. And every Tuesday night I'm at Hot Soup at Irish Exit, or most Tuesday nights anyway, which is in Midtown East. And yeah, I'll be on the road in like Chicago in May and some other places, but I have to look at my schedule. But
that's great.
Go to MattRubyComedy.com. You can sign up for my email list and I'll tell you about stuff.
Thanks so much, Matt.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
All right. Take it easy, everybody.